Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I want to talk about the buildup to the Open Championship. Now, in that buildup, there was a lot of talk about Rory McIlroy, about Brooks Koepka, Phil Mickelson, Tiger Woods. Lots of talk about lots of different guys. However, not a lot of talk about Shane Lowry. If you want to talk odds, for instance, you could have gotten him anywhere from 55 to 1 all the way to 105 to 1. So what happens? He goes out and he shoots a 67 in the first round. Very nice Thursday. A nice round. A really nice round. But even with that 67, it had that feel of a name that jumps up on Thursday, but then fades away quickly. But he then backed that up with another 67 on Friday. Again, good round. Nice round. In fact, make that two nice rounds. Still, that's inevitably where the big dogs take over. Somebody will come out and shoot a monster score on Saturday, and Lowry fades, never to be heard from ever again. And that's exactly what did happen. A big dog did jump up and take over. Somebody did shoot a monster round on Saturday. But that somebody was Shane Lowry. A bogey-free 63. So, 67, 67, 63. And with that, the 148th Open Championship was over by Saturday night. I mean, sure, there were still 18 holes to play. And you still had guys like Brooks Koepka and Tommy Fleetwood, a.k.a. Golfing Jesus, who were on the leaderboard, technically. But there's no way you were running down Shane Lowry. At least that's what the entire world thought. But not necessarily the guy himself. Not when he still had that 2016 U.S. Open at Oakmont, still rattling around in his dome. He was still thinking about having a four-shot lead after 54 holes, only to shoot 76 coming in Sunday and come from ahead to lose. He still had the scar tissue from that. I mean, of course, who wouldn't? As he said, the days after the U.S. Open were torture, and he drove himself insane with all the what-ifs, what could have beens. Maybe that's why he didn't sleep so well Saturday night. Maybe that's why he was up so early Sunday morning. Maybe that's why he said this afterwards.
I suppose I didn't even know going out this morning if I was good enough to win a major, you know?
It's a really honest answer, right? I didn't even know myself this morning if I was good enough to win a major. Well, he got his answer. He is good enough to win a major. Yesterday was not perfect. Far from it. He had his shakiest round of the tournament, yet he still came to the 18th green, and he had this moment.
Shane Lowry is the Open champion. The return of the Open to Royal Portrush has been an absolute triumph. And just to set the seal on an unforgettable week, an Irishman has won in Ireland.
Shane Lowry, I tweeted it. I'll say it again right here. Sheer domination. That was a monster performance. An absolute masterclass in how to dominate a course and a field. And that's how you bust out of the shadow of guys like Darren Clarke, Patrick Harrington, Graham McDowell, Rory McIlroy. By coming to the first Open Championship in Northern Ireland in nearly 70 years and smashing up the entire field. And the fact is, while no one was really talking about him coming in, it's not like he came out of nowhere. I mean, the talent's been there. We know this. There's a story from back in the day of swing guru Pete Cowan seeing a bunch of young Irish golfers, including Rory, and his response after watching them play was, quote, "Rory's going to be great, but there's another good one out there, the little fat lad with the glasses," end quote. Let's take a moment and stop on that for a minute. Why don't we stop on the little fat lad with glasses. As great a win as that is, notice nobody's saying, damn, this dude looks more like an NFL linebacker than he does a golfer. You know why nobody's saying that? Because he doesn't look like a linebacker. And he does look like a golfer. Or at least the way golfers used to look before the Cat, Brooks, I don't know, Gary Woodland showed up. And that little fat lad with glasses is now the champion golfer of the year. And it happened just a year after that little fat lad with glasses was crying in the parking lot at Carnoustie. It's not me saying that. He admitted it himself. He was crying in the parking lot at Carnoustie. Because he said yesterday, after he missed the cut in the Open in 2017, he was having a really hard time.
Golf's a weird sport, and you never know what's around the corner, and that's why you always kind of need to remind yourself, and you need to have the people there to remind you that you need to just fight through the bad times. And, you know, I sat in the car park in Carnoustie on the Thursday, it's probably, you know, almost like a year ago right to this week, and I cried. My golf wasn't my friend at the time. It was something that it was becoming very stressful, and it was weighing on me, and I just didn't like doing it. And look, 12, what a difference a year makes, I suppose.
How do you not love that guy? Hell yes, what a difference a year makes. You go from being in a spot where you don't like the game and the game doesn't like you, to being on top of the game, from blubbering out in the parking lot to drinking out of the claret jug in only a year's time. I mean, somehow this guy got right. Somehow he turned it all around. He got his game right, he got his head right, and then he had that moment yesterday. And again, it's not just what he did, but how he did it. He was under immense pressure. Maybe not Rory pressure, who came in as the favorite and the native son, but big pressure nonetheless. And my guy was not fazed by it at all this week. Being from Ireland, playing essentially in front of your home fans all weekend, no problem at all. And the pressure that seemed to get to Rory never got to Lowry. Again, he wasn't facing the same kind of level of scrutiny, but when the pressure did build up, after the first two rounds, he stomped it out with that epic 63 on Saturday. But the best part about this guy isn't that he was too cool for the whole thing. There were so many great lines from his press conference. Quote, "I feel like this is an out-of-body experience. I was so calm coming down the last. It was so hard out there. I wasn't doing so well around the turn, but everyone else was struggling. I just had to focus on staying as far ahead of Tommy as I could." He went on to say, quote, "I talked a lot to Bo, my caddy. I couldn't stop thinking about winning, but that was after six or seven holes," end quote. And what about those conversations with his caddy? What were they talking about?
You know, I kept on telling him how nervous I was, how scared I was, how much I didn't want to mess it up.
Man, that's so good. That is so good to me. Like, one golfer after another will try and tell you they were so focused, they were so locked in, they didn't even think about winning. They were just about the next shot. They were just about the process. This guy's admitting he couldn't stop thinking about winning, that he was almost distracted by it. He admitted to his caddy, "I'm scared, man. I'm scared." And why wouldn't he be? He had never won a major. He had one top 10 finish on the PGA Tour in 2017. He was crying in the parking lot last year. Of course the guy was scared. He's just the only dude ever brave enough to admit that he was scared. And then finally, if you think that he was distracted, check out his grandmother. She told RTE, yesterday was not an easy day.
Was it tough watching at the weekend?
Oh, terrible. Emotional now it was. I hadn't slept last night. I hadn't drank a brandy since 2009. I drank 2 years and it nearly killed me.
Grams. She said, "I hadn't had a brandy in 10 years. And I had two yesterday," and quote, "it's nearly killed me." That's two for me, in other words.
That's two for me.
That's two for Grandma. One jug for her grandson. Two brandies for Grandma. And an awesome moment for all of Ireland. And it had nothing to do with Rory. Go figure. Josh Heupel is my guest. Josh, really good to have you back. How are you?
Yeah, doing great, man. Appreciate you having me on.
Always good to have you, Josh. So we're about a month away from kickoff against Florida A&M in the Bounce House right here on CBS Sports Network. So how is life right now, and how excited are you to get the season underway?
Hey, we're ready to get back. Players are finishing up their summer workouts. They're ready for a week off before we start training camp. Coaches are all back in the office chomping at the bit. We're ready to go, man. Put the ball down. Let's go play.
All right, then. From the outside, you made it look like that first season was a relatively easy thing. I'm not saying it was, but you did go 12-0 in the regular season. You won that conference title. You went to the Fiesta Bowl where you lost a one-score game to LSU despite the fact that Mackenzie Milton had been injured against South Florida. As you look back on it, was it as easy as you made it look?
There's nothing easy in college football. There's certainly nothing easy each and every Saturday afternoon. Our players did a phenomenal job of buying into our program, our expectations, and who and what we were going to be every day. They competed every week to get themselves ready to go play championship caliber football. We had a ball bounce our way a couple of times, and we got a great staff too. And so, as good as year one is, fully expect that we're going to be better in year two.
Listen, is there something that is interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? If so, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, grief, self-esteem, and more. You can connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. Anything you share is confidential, and it's so convenient. And you can get help at your own time and at your own pace. You can schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. And if you're not happy with your counselor for any reason, you can request a new one at any time and no additional charge. And best of all, it really is an affordable option. And if you're listening right now to this podcast, you can get 10% off your first month with the discount code ROME. The discount code is ROME. So why not get started right now? Go to BetterHelp.com/ROME. Simply fill out a short questionnaire and get matched up with a counselor that you will love. BetterHelp.com/ROME. BetterHelp.com/ROME. UCF head coach Josh Heupel is joining us. You know, there was a time not that long ago where an undefeated regular season at UCF would have been a reason to party. And again, I don't want to understate the accomplishment at all or all the hard work that went into it. But at the same time, does it feel now like that's the actual expectation there?
Our fan base, absolutely. They expect to win every ball game. But those expectations aren't any higher than what our expectations are from our players and coaches. We work extremely hard. You know, all year long to put ourselves in a position. We understand that we got to go out and earn it every Saturday. But we certainly we like that noise that surrounds our program.
You know, Josh, one of your guys, offensive lineman Jordan Johnson, I thought had a really interesting quote. I want to read you this. He said, quote, "I don't want to be that guy who's like, I could have been this. I want to do it now. I want to grind as hard as I can now and not try and work out when I'm 30 years old and it's too late. I want to put in that work right now." I mean, to me, it's really interesting because we're talking about a guy who has started 38 games and who's won 25 of his last 26. So what does it tell you that that guy's not satisfied?
I think it speaks to the urgency of JJ, but it speaks to the urgency inside of our locker room, our entire program, to be as good as we can, as fast as we can. And we talk about being in a race against ourselves individually, as a football team and as a program, each and every day. And, you know, we expect excellence. We demand it of the guy next to us, and we're going to continue to build a really unique place, a unique brand of football here at UCF.
See, that's really interesting to me, too. Like, when you say we want to be as good as we can, as fast as we can, is that proverbial, I want to be 1% better every single day, I want to get incrementally better, or are we expecting to make major, major progress quickly?
I think it does speak to the small victories that happen every day. You know, working as hard as you can, maximum output on every rep and every set inside of the weight room. It speaks to, you know, how we want to be academically, how we want to be socially, the small gains that you're going to make. But when you make enough small gains, we fully expect our football team and individuals to make huge, giant leaps as well. And I think, you know, as we get into training camp, be able to look back to where our kids started in their summer workouts when we started in May, there's a dramatic difference. You know, for us, year two versus year one, there's a dramatic difference. And those are the types of growth that we need to continue to have inside of our program.
We're talking to Josh Heupel. Josh, what about you as the head coach from year two back to year one? How different does it all feel to you now that you've got that year under your belt and you've been with the guys for a year?
Yeah, I'm a seasoned veteran now, right?
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Exactly. I think it's, you know, as good of a place as we were inside of our program when we left to go out to the Fiesta Bowl, certainly we didn't play the way we wanted to in the bowl game. But even that has, you know, served us well. I think just in year two, our players' comfort and understanding in what we want to be about inside of our building. We're one of six programs to have every single staff member back in college football. The communication between our coaches is at a higher level. And I think all of those things let your players feel really comfortable when they walk into the building every day. They're excited about what they're doing because they fully understand what they are trying to accomplish every day. And I think that will lend itself to us continuing to make strides inside of our program.
UCF head football coach Josh Heupel joins us. Now, from a recruiting standpoint, there's a story about a spring practice where you had 175 high school recruits on campus, not for a spring game or a huge event, but for a midweek practice. Now, you've been at some pretty high-profile programs. Have you ever seen anything like that before?
Yeah, it's really just unique, and I fully did not understand the recruiting cycle and what the opportunity it would be being here in Orlando. But I think being uniquely situated in the middle of one of the best states in America to recruit kids from, just as far as talent pools and the accessibility that so many young student athletes have, it's really unique. You know, there were 170 kids on campus. I think we had 20 plus kids that were offered that day that were at that night practice. The ability to get kids on campus and showcase what your program is about, the facilities that you have, is truly unique here. And as we continue to develop, a top 20 program year in and year out, and our facilities continue to improve, our recruiting is going to continue to improve, just like it has the two recruiting cycles that I've been here.
All right, so in that vein, when you talk about being a top 20 program year in and year out, your AD, Danny White, said, quote, "We're going to build a monster in Orlando at UCF, and we are going to be a major player in college football, whatever college football looks like," end quote. I would imagine you share that sentiment and that vision. So what's a monster look like to you, and how close are you to that goal?
Fastest growing city, job growth city in America, second largest university in the country, alumni base, fan base, the passion that resides around our program is unique to UCF. I think this is our 40th year of playing college football ever. I think our school is, just over 50-some years old. It is the most unique story in college athletics and in college football, in my opinion. And there's no doubt about it that this will be a monster. Like I said earlier in the show, we truly are in a race against ourselves to get there as fast as we possibly can.
Josh Heupel joins us for a few more moments. Josh, in terms of Mackenzie Milton, who I mentioned, the injury he suffered, knowing what he's meant to the program and what that injury was like, what was that like for you personally, and what's it been like to watch him start that comeback?
Yeah, I mean, catastrophic injury right there, on the playing field, and being across the field, didn't understand it till I got over there. And as everyone knows now in college football, the story, I mean, you really are just worried about him keeping his leg initially, then you want him to get back to living a normal life, and then ultimately come back and play at an elite level. And he's still on his journey. I think everyone inside of our program, those first few moments, 5 minutes on the field, our hearts broke and sank for him. We had great leadership inside of our program that called everybody up once he was carted off and said, all right, now it's time for us to go win a football game and to do what we came here to do. And our kids are resilient. They're focused. They play with the chip on their shoulder, but they play with the purpose for Mackenzie as well. And KZ's been inside of our program every day since. He's sitting in our quarterback meeting room. He's out with them during the summer coaching them up. He's continuing to rehab. He's in the weight room with our guys. We fully still believe that he's going to come back and be an even better player than he was.
Man, really speaks to his character. And then when he went down, Daryl Mack Jr. took over a quarterback, but then he broke his ankle earlier this month. My sense from talking to you in the past is you're never going to make excuses. So how do you approach the quarterback position coming into this season? Is it Brandon Wimbush's job, or is there going to be a battle?
No, there was a battle going into to training camp, even with DJ being healthy. We came out of spring ball. Felt like we had a group of quarterbacks that were really playing really good football. And you know this, Jim. Typically in a quarterback derby, there's a guy that's going to play poorly enough that he kicks himself out of it. We didn't have that as we went through the 15 days of spring ball. We'll have a competition when we get in training camp. Brandon Wimbush, obviously, the amount of football that he's played, his experiences, give him an opportunity to get himself to play at a championship level. But we got a couple of kids on campus in Quadri Jones, a kid that redshirted last year, and DG, Dylan Gabriel, a true freshman from Hawaii, actually played at Mackenzie Milton's high school right there in Hawaii that's enrolled in January as well. Those guys will all battle it out here early in training camp.
Hey, Josh, finally, you're not looking to make it about you, but last month it was announced that you are on the ballot for the College Football Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you, and what did it mean to your kids? Like, what do they think of that?
It means I'm getting old, first of all. inside of our program, a couple of the players recognized it and it gave me maybe a little bit more more swag with my former playing days, I think. And then my two kids, they recognized some of the names that were on the ballot as well. They thought it was pretty cool that I was being recognized with some of those guys.
That is
so
cool.
It was a positive deal.
That is cool. That is a positive deal, and that is cool. He is the head football coach at UCF. They're going to open up their season against Florida A&M August 29th right here on CBS Sports Network. It's a 7:30 p.m. Eastern start. Make note of that. Josh, great to have you back. Appreciate the conversation very much, man. Good luck.
I appreciate it.
Brian in Omaha, Nebraska. Brian, what's going on? How are you?
Romy, how's it going, baby?
Good, man. How about you?
Dude, I can't complain. Spent all day yesterday on the couch hungover. Well deserved. Friday, me and a few of the boys, Dave from Berea, Kirby in the 402, and Scotty PhD, we played out at Quarry Oaks, top 100 public course in the country. Place was beautiful. Berea and my wife and I, we all went out to dinner. Next day, we woke up bright and early, played up at the Players Club. We had 20 people. 11 listeners, 9 contributors, decided to go out and try and play 27 holes. 18 was good enough for about half of them. Some of the other guys made it through about 22 holes. A little blacked out at that point. One of our other guys, Jeff, he was hosting a barbecue up at his house. Made a great pork butt, fired up a hell of a lot of wings. Then we decided to hit the bar. Some of us cut it at about 1:30 in the morning. Kyle and Green Bay got into a fight. Wanted to get into a fight with a dude that was about 60 mocking him for his boat shoes. And then I guess he and a couple other guys might have hit the strip club, but I was passed out somewhere behind the bar in my own vomit. But, hey, it was worth it.
My man, so tell me really quickly, who was the best golfer and who was the worst?
There's a lot of bad golfers. But Dave and Casey and I, we both fired out of 79. I think with Berea's handicap, he shot about a net 78, and I think he's got about a 42 handicap. So, good thing we made it a net game for him, because he left his trophy in the back of my van. He's definitely not getting that thing back till next year.
1-800-636-8686. Anybody else who was there? This guy was. Jeff, also in Omaha. Jeff, good to have you. How are you?
Great. How are you doing, Romy?
Good, good. Tell me about the weekend. How did it go?
It was awesome. Kyle is everything and then some that he's built up to be. The guy can party all night long, and he can bounce back the next morning like nothing happened. It's amazing. Brian and Bugahaw and Purvey in the 402, Dave and Berea, Dave and Casey via Rome, all those guys were just a blast to be with. The best golfers for sure were Brian and Dave and Casey via Rome. But the funniest thing of the weekend, I know Kyle had a little brush, but I would say the breakfast we had in the morning yesterday was pretty amazing because he ordered chocolate milk.
Man, that's how he bounces back, man. Chocolate milk. That's the answer. Yeah. Let's just get right at it. Rex in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Happy Monday, Rex.
Thanks, Romy. You too. I'm so sick of these weight-obsessed clones cracking on everybody who's slightly pudgy. Hey, lames, the best players at the Open were Lowry, J.B. Holmes, and Lee Westwood. Their BMIs don't meet your lofty standards. Meanwhile, Tiger Duval and everybody else who wrenches their back stacking weight were watching from their hotel room, and those fasting on coffee grounds ended up boarding their G5 on Friday on their way back to Rancho Santa Fe. Golf's about speed, talent, and the mental game, not muscle-bound, knuckle-dragging Neanderthals. Out.
That was straight. Rack him. Good job, Rex. Kyle, how was the weekend? How did it compare to some of your other jungle weekends?
Man, this was, I got to put it up there, man. That was one of the best weekends I've had. We're all Midwesterners, so we all just like to get beer, talk sports, talk politics. We had a great time. I did hit the strip club with another clone. I'm not going to say who, but it was a weird strip club. They couldn't show like
they couldn't show everything. So I'm like, what the hell is going on here? They almost get in a fight. I was talking to some woman. She tried to introduce me to her husband. He wasn't having any of that. Luckily, Brian got in the middle, stopped it. But I got the Indy 500 all the way. I got the Jungle Open all the way. Next coming up is the Green Bay Clone Stock Thursday night against the Eagles. It's going to be fun. Clones start taking off work. Get this thing rally this year. And then New York, Houston, Detroit in October. So I'm still out here. I'm getting it, Rome. Now I got to get that golden ticket. Show some of these bums how I do it, really. And that's all I got for today, Rome.
Hey, Kyle, really quickly. So what happened in that bar? Did you step out of line? Were you speaking inappropriately to this lady? How did you almost get into a fight? What happened?
I was just hitting on her. I'm like, oh, so where's this husband out of yours? And she's like, oh, right there. I'm like, oh, that loser. And then I came out for his boat shoes, his dad looked shoes, and gave him a look, and he wasn't happy with it. And he got kicked out of the bar. We did it. So we sang karaoke the rest of the night and had a blast. So,
you hit on this guy's lady. You insulted this guy, and he was the one who got kicked out of the bar.
Yes, sir.
Dave in Berea on the call-in line. Dave, what's going on? How are you? How was the weekend?
Rome, what a time to be alive, brother. My goodness. I tell you, man, it's good to be back in South Carolina after a 21-hour airport stay. Good grief. But, hey, man, I wouldn't have traded it for the world. Man, we had an incredible time. The hospitality from the Midwest guys, they are incredible, brother. Also, a special shout-out to 512 Lumber. Man, that dude made an awesome sign as far as where we all signed it and everything for the inaugural Jungle Open. But, brother, man, it was incredible. Had a great time. And just to show you their hospitality, I don't know how the hell I won this thing. These guys are like 1 in 3 handicaps. I'm honestly like a 25 handicap. I don't know what the heck happened, but thanks, guys. And, B, if you don't mind, get the club to me. I need that to hang in my office. And one more thing about Colin Green Bay. Okay, true story real fast. We all met the next day when I was about to take off on my bird. And sure enough, Colin Green Bay was like, so what really happened, man? And he was like, hey, dude, well, you know, honestly, I mean, I'm not going to let a guy with boat shoes pump me down. And I look down and I'm like, hey, man, I'm standing right here. I had the same exact boat shoes on that he was talking about. My man, take it easy on boat shoes, brother. But anyway, hey, man, we loved it, man. And, hey, dude, let's do it again next year. Wore the Jungle Open. Holla, deuces.
My man, congrats on the win. JJ in KC. JJ, what's up? How are you?
Romy Van Smack, brother. Thanks for the call, man. Or thanks for taking my call. Hey, this thing reminded me of the Kansas City tour stop back in the day. It had that max level of fun. It was just epic start to finish. There was so much sports talk and smack and booze and beer. It was great. And, yeah, I think I had more beers than I lost golf balls, so I think that's a win for me. And just to kind of set the stage here, we had, you know, speakers going in the golf carts everywhere. I know I caught up on the podcast with Todd Furman. That was so epic. I am hoping the boys at CBS Sports Radio would put that picture up of a 512 Lumber sign and us with cardboard Romy. It was great. I'm definitely coming back for the 2021 because – if I can be on the course, have some action with these guys, and maybe take an elk online and trying to win a little money that way, that was even better. The only downside is Sunday got rained out here in Omaha, and I can just imagine the carnage that would have happened if we played one more day. But, hey, it's a story for next year. Romy, peace. Love the show, man.
Nice job, JJ. Way to represent. No matter how big or small your team is, Ferguson has a winning game plan for pro contractors. With thousands of plumbing repair parts, knowledgeable associates, and the largest national footprint in the game, when the pressure is on, you can count on Ferguson. Robert Lucetich is my guest. Robert, good to have you back. How are you?
Romy, always good to grab a vine and venture into the jungle.
My man, I appreciate you saying it. And let me ask you about Shane Lowry to start. He made no secret, Robert, of the fact that he had some serious scar tissue from not closing it out when he had that 54-hole lead at Oakmont a few years back, that he was crying in the parking lot at Carnoustie last year when he didn't make the cut. So what changed for him?
You know, I think that it certainly wasn't that he didn't have the talent. And I think that he showed, obviously, that he had the talent. But one of the things that was I really noted is that he needed a little pep-me-up session, which, as an Irishman would do, you'd go to the Bushmills Distillery to have it before the Open. And, you know, I think that, as he said, he he confronted some truths about himself, about his game. And really, I think when you have that level of awareness and you just put your mind to it, there's certainly no question that Shane Lowry is one of the you know, really most combative and competitive golfers out there. But, you know, Oakmont hurt him, obviously. And a lot of guys, though, you know, when they first get to that place at a major, and it's you know, it's very hard to close the deal. We're not talking about, you know, your Sunday morning giggle. It's these are the best players in the world, and if they sense just that little bit of weakness, they're just going to step on your throat, and you become roadkill, and that's what happened to him. And I think that one of the cool things that he did that I, you know, others noted too, is he just decided he was going to hit a sort of a bleeding cut off the tee, and he went with it the entire time. And it's very tempting to sort of say, you know, let's go back to hitting a draw here, but he just As all the greats will tell you, you know, you take one side of the golf course out of play and just work the ball the other way, and he did that. But more than anything, I think, I mean, he just showed an incredible constitution. And look, I don't know that I can remember, Romy, a more popular winner. Certainly Tiger winning the Masters was up there in terms of popularity. But in terms of the venue, in terms of the moment, in terms of where he's from, this is one of the great majors. And I think for the you know, the first thing that he said is, this is for Ireland, all of Ireland, you know. And unfortunately, you know, Ireland has been divided in for many years, and I think there are enough good people there now to look at this and say, you know, okay, you might be a Protestant, I might be a Catholic, but we're all from the same place. And Shane Lowry certainly helped bring Ireland together yesterday with this win. They all were behind him.
Very well said. Robert Lucetich is my guest, a golf analyst, also the author of Unplayable, an inside account of Tiger's most tumultuous season. So, Robert, yeah, Brooks Koepka, I'll move on to him because I thought you covered that extensively. That was well done. He finished in the top five for the fifth straight major. That's a run that includes a pair of wins. What does that level of dominance say about him and his game right now, and really a top five finish when he was not on top of his game necessarily?
No, I mean, the guy's a Terminator, isn't he? He's like the next level Terminator. You know, what really, really actually I can't explain about Brooks Koepka is that he's able to turn the switch on and off like I've never seen a golfer. Golfers typically get into a phase where they're playing well and they ride that wave, and then the wave ends. And, you know, it might be a few weeks, it might be a few months, it might be even a year. But Koepka is just a unique creature because, you know, he just has no problem finishing 50th in the 3M Open in Minnesota, or, you know, just sort of an also-ran in these smaller tour events. But as soon as the majors come around, he kicks it up into another gear. And, you know, again, I would say he finished fourth, and I don't remember that guy making a putt. So, yeah, I mean, certainly he lost by nine, so let's not get too carried away with that narrative. But It really says something about what he has found as a golfer that can make him just get to the best of his game at the right time. I mean, Tiger would always say you've got to peak four times a year in this sport, and Koepka has mastered that. And I tell you, I mean, three wins, by the way, if you go back six majors. So he's really done something that's honestly very Tiger-esque, and it's frightening to think that if he starts making a few putts, all of a sudden he's going to be at the top every single time. And I just don't see any signs of it abating.
Robert Lucetich joins us again. So, Robert, what'd you make of that dynamic between J.B. Holmes, a rather slow player, and Brooks, who likes to keep it moving, especially when Holmes was plumb bobbing double bogey putts? I mean, he seemed like Brooks was being very careful with his word choice after the round itself. Did you have any problem with the way Holmes was going about his round?
I mean, I have a problem with the way Holmes goes about his round every time he plays.
There you go.
And I think a lot of players do. As Koepka said, he's not the only one. But, you know, it was interesting. I thought it was a good point that Koepka made. He didn't just sort of pile on, but he said, look, when it's your turn to hit, why are you just now taking out your glove, putting it on, and starting to think about the shot? What have you been doing while you're waiting for the other guy? And certainly J.B. Holmes is guilty of that. He doesn't start thinking about his shot until it's his turn. And and then he takes an eternity over it. But I think there's certainly no doubt there's a handful of turtles out there that are just, you know, they've worked the system. They know how the system works, which is when the PGA Tour is never going to give you an actual stroke penalty, and which they should, because, I mean, is it any different to, you know, not shooting a basketball within 45 seconds? You know, it's like you shouldn't be able to still have your shot if it's going to take that long. And because the slow player never gets hurt by slow play. It's always the other guy that gets hurt because they've got to wait. They're out of their routine. You're never out of your routine. But they're very good at getting back into position when they've been told they're out of position. They rush to get back into position, but then they get slow again as soon as they're back in position. But the other thing to say about this is that Koepka is really growing into, you know, the number one player in the world, not just, you know, in the rankings, but he's starting to have that, have opinions. He's starting to say, this is the way I think things should be, and really growing into this number one player. And I actually sort of applaud it, because a lot of times you get guys that don't want to say anything. They don't want to upset the apple cart. Or you get a guy, you know, like a Tiger guy who's not a very political character. And, you know, Koepka seems like he is going to tell you what he thinks. And, you know, we might not all like it, but I really like the fact that he's got this voice.
I love it. I love it. I couldn't be more happy about it. And it, to me, the crown fits really well, and it's getting more and more comfortable. I love what I'm seeing and hearing from him. Robert Lucetich is joining us. Now, Robert, when you look at the run that Koepka's on right now, he is the first player since Jordan Spieth in 2015 to finish top five in all four majors in the same year. At that time, Spieth looked like he could be on the verge of dominating golf for a long time. What happened to him, and do you see him getting it back?
Well, look, I mean, Jordan Spieth was just an incredible natural talent. But, you know, when he was a kid, he would go play and his coach would say, you know, what did you shoot? And he'd say 66. So what's his coach going to do? I mean, let's change your swing, kid. No, I mean, he was going out there and winning and dominating. So he does have a different kind of a swing. I would say that you know, with a little bit of a chicken wing finish, I don't know that he, I mean, there's plenty of golf nerd pinheads are going to tell me that the stats show that he was a great ball striker, but you know, you've got to look at, you know, what do your eyes tell you? And the greatness of Jordan for me was that he could always get up and down out of a trash can, and that was really, at some point, that tends to be not so easy to do. You can't go through an entire career doing it. If you look at like a Brooks Koepka, and he's hitting green after green after green, and he doesn't make the putt, so you say, well, he didn't have a great day. But when you're Jordan and you're missing greens and you don't get up and down, you didn't have the birdie putt. You're putting for par, and then you miss those. And again, he's certainly struggled with some of the short ones. What I love about that kid, though, is that he has just a burning desire. He's got a lot of guts. He's got a lot of fight in him. And I do not expect that Jordan Spieth is going to be lying down. But he does have some demons to overcome.
He is an analyst. He's the author of Unplayable, an inside account of Tiger's most tumultuous season. Robert, before you go, in terms of Tiger, when he won the Masters, there was suddenly all this talk about how he's going to run down Jack's mark for majors. But in the next three majors, he had a couple of missed cuts and only one round in the 60s. What do you make of how he played, and in particular, what he said about his body after the first round of this week?
Well, I mean, look, nobody has been more hurt by the condensation of the condensing of the PGA Tour schedule than Tiger Woods, because he has always, even in his pomp, he was a warm weather golfer, and not having the Akron event, the Bridgestone Invitational, not having that in August and followed by the PGA, I think is going to hurt him in his quest to catch Jack, because potentially, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but if you get a cold year at the Masters, and then now you're looking at a PGA in May, if it's on the East Coast, that could also be, as it was this year, the weather not being great. Then you could go to a US Open in June, and depending on the venue, again, maybe not get warmth. And then for sure, when you go to the Open, there's a good chance you're going to get cold and rain. This is hurting him, because there's no doubt in my mind that his body does not respond very well to the cold and the wet and the rain. And he had a bad body language from minute one last week. I think the other issue, obviously, is his preparedness. And, it, you know, he's just deciding that in between majors he won't play a tournament. And I just think it doesn't look like a strategy that's going to work very well. Adam Scott did it this time. How'd that work out? Not so good. So, you know, Tiger is sort of going with this concept of, I'm going to play as many majors as I can, so I'm going to save myself, in a sense, and not get too burned out. I know he felt burned out at the end of last year, but we will know more about Tiger in the coming month or so in the FedEx Cup playoffs, because when the weather gets warm, if he starts getting back to what he was doing, you know, Masters-like, then I think that we will see what the pattern will be in the future for Tiger, which is, if the weather's decent and it's warm, he's got a chance. If it's not, he really doesn't have a chance. But, you know, somebody who follows golf quite closely said to me last week that I wonder, excuse me, he said, I wonder if Tiger, if that Masters win was Jack in 86 at Augusta. And, you know, I had not thought of it that way, because that he was so comprehensive in the way that he played so well, shaped the ball. He did everything well. He was clearly the best player. It wasn't a fluke win at Augusta this year. But I have to say, you know, there's certainly got to be alarm bells ringing for Tiger Woods. And again, I don't know. Personally, is Tiger going to, you know, not lose any sleep over not getting Jack's record? I actually don't think he will. But I think he was very, very happy and very proud that he won this Masters, just to show people that he could. But again, we'll know more about Tiger in the next month or so.
So, Robert, really quickly, what do we know about Phil right now? And how do you think Phil Mickelson is processing the missed cut after talking all about losing all that weight the way he did to get right?
Well, listen, Phil, first of all, Phil is always just Phil. He's always got an idea. It's two drivers, it's no drivers, it's losing weight, it's wearing, you know, two rain gloves. There's always something going on in that. That guy's got one of those minds that doesn't stop. Unfortunately, he's going to have to find a way to deal with Father Time, because, you know, he's looking like an older golfer. And if you look at what happens to golfers in their late 40s, nothing very good, frankly. Like the rest of us, Jim.
Like the rest of us.
But Rory, you know, and one last thing on Rory. I think Rory is an interesting character, and I think that he is somewhat lost at the moment, because I think he knows that when he's good, he's very, very good, but he doesn't know what to do when it goes pear-shaped. He gets frustrated, and you can see it in the way that he plays. And there's no way he should have missed the cut at this event, and he somehow did. It was such an emotional time. But again, sometimes with Rory, I feel like the pressure, like it is at Augusta when he tries to win there, trying to break through there still, I think that it gets to him, and he's going to have to find a way to block that out.
He is an analyst. He is the author of Unplayable, an inside account of Tiger's most tumultuous season. Good friend of the program, and frankly, nobody better. Robert, so good to have you back. Really appreciate that conversation. Thank you.
You got it, man. See you next time.
Ross Tucker, NFL. Ross, what's up? How you doing, man?
Football season blew up, man. I'm doing great. I'm ready to get this thing going. You ready?
Oh, man, you know I am, Russ. You know it. In fact, to that point, rookies have reported to some camps already. Others are coming in this week. When this time of year rolls around, do you ever get the itch to get back out there again? Do you miss any part of training camp?
No, not training camp. I miss the games. But, man, I thank my lucky stars around this time of year every year that I'm not still playing, because look, it's a great thing, Jim. Obviously, you know, you make a lot of money and you want to play as long as you can and all that stuff. But I promise you, if you ask a lot of the NFL players and they were being honest, they would tell you these couple days are the worst days of the year, because you know what's hanging over you. And I'm not saying this for anybody to feel bad for them. I'm just saying this because they know camp starts Wednesday or Thursday or Friday, and that their free time, their freedom's just about over. I mean, technically, the guys get Tuesdays off during the season. There was never a Tuesday I didn't go into the facility. So it's fine. It comes with the territory. But like anything else in life, it's hanging over your head that you got about 6 months where you don't have a single off day. You know the anxiety, the stress, the pain that you're about to go through. So these couple days are kind of the calm before the storm, but it's not a nice calm, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Ross Tucker is joining us. All right, Ross, on Friday the news broke that Tyreek Hill was not going to be suspended by the league. Now, it's not exactly clear how his child suffered that broken arm as well as the other injuries. And then there is the audio that was released, so we don't know all the evidence. But when a child suffers a broken arm and was reportedly removed from Hill's custody, and then we hear a threat made by Hill, does it seem strange to you that he was not suspended?
Yeah, I was surprised. I really was. You know, a couple things here, Jim, because, you know, I see these reports where doctors said it was an accident. Okay, well, then how did the accident happen would be my question, right? And a couple different things that need to be talked about here. We don't have all the facts. The NFL interviewed him 8.5 hours, all that stuff. Here's two facts we do know, and I'm so glad you brought them up. Number one, the child is with Child Protective Services. And even if you say, okay, the broken arm was an accident, the child had bruises and welts all over his body as a three-year-old, number one. Number two, we have audio, and there's a longer version, and different people have different theories regarding the audio, but we definitely hear Tyreek Hill threaten the mother of his child on that audio. So those are two indisputable facts. I thought that that would be enough for him to be suspended at least a little bit, a few games, even though there's no evidence, theoretically, that he actually hit the child. But here's the thing, Jim. I really think the NFL looked at this and said, if we suspend him for a game or two, people are going to say that we're going light on him, that we feel like he did something wrong, but we're not really being punitive enough. If we don't suspend him at all, if we go zero games, we can just say, look, there's no evidence he did anything. There's nothing we can do. Our hands are tied. There's no evidence. I think psychologically, they felt like zero games, Jim, was a safer haven than if they went one or two.
Ross Tucker joining us. You know, I think there's something to that. But Ross, overall, like when you look at the way the league has handled these things in the past few years, Tom Brady was suspended for air in footballs. And as recently as 2 years ago, Ezekiel Elliott was suspended 6 games for violating the league's personal conduct policy. And then today, Ian Rappaport tweeted that Seattle's Jaron Reed was suspended 6 games for an incident from 2017 where he wasn't ever charged or arrested. So when you see all of that, does the league at least need to do a better job of explaining why Hill was not suspended?
1,000%. I mean, I don't even remember this Jaron Reed incident. I had to look it up after Ian Rappaport tweeted that, and you said it, he was neither charged nor arrested for a domestic violence incident back in 2017. That's all the information we have. So we all have to sit here and think, okay, why is Jaron Reed, who's a very, very good player, by the way, missing 6 games, and Tyreek Hill, whose child was taken away from him, and the audio we heard, which was horrific, not suspended at all. And I don't think it's enough for the NFL or the Chiefs or even Tyreek Hill to hide behind, well, it's still an open investigation and legal proceedings. I don't know about you, Jim, but if people were saying that I broke my three-year-old child's arm, immediately that day, I would say I did nothing of the sort. I can tell you that right now. There was an accident. Whatever the deal was, at a minimum, and I tweeted this, at a minimum, I'd just like to hear from Tyreek Hill what happened to his child. I don't think that's asking too much. If there's an easy explanation, then let's hear it.
Unless maybe there's not one, right? Ross Tucker is joining us. You're right. If there's nothing there, I'd be shouting it from the rooftops, for sure. Especially if somebody said that about me and my kids. Now, Ross, you and I have talked in the past about Rob Gronkowski and his health and the advice that you would give him as a former player. He did announce his retirement back in March, but ever since then, there's been some suggestion that he might come back. First off, when you see photos of him from last month, Ross, does he look like he's ready to come back as a tight end?
Well, I saw one picture where he looked really thin. He said that those pictures weren't real. I saw some more recent pictures from like an all-star game where he looked a little bit better to me. Now, he hasn't been lifting, but he still looks to me like he's probably in the 240s, maybe even 250. You know, he's a guy that was 270-plus when he was playing. So I think if he did come back, they probably wouldn't ask him to do a whole lot on the blocking side of things, and it would be more to give Brady a reliable weapon in the passing game. I'm just really – maybe it's good for his businesses or whatever he's doing after football to keep the speculation going, but I'd be really disappointed if I were one of his brothers and he came back to play. I mean, just knowing what I know and knowing all the surgeries he's had – and where he's at in life, if he were my brother and he's got four of them, I would just say, Rob, why would you even consider this? But, you know, the flip side of that is I'm sure it's intoxicating to go to the Super Bowls, to win them, and that feeling of, you know, people wanting you. I think I've seen a couple times where people have suggested that if Brady made a personal plea to him, that might change his mind. So we'll see. At a minimum, it seems like it's going to be a storyline throughout this entire season.
Ross Tucker joining us. All right, quickly, Ross, I don't want to publicly shame anybody, but I saw you out recently. You took a photo of a condiment area, what you described as a burger, hot dog, and fries joint. There was a ketchup pump, but there was no mustard pump. I don't even need to ask the question. I know how you feel about that, but I need to ask you this. Where, and I'm really, man, I hope you answer this the way I want you to answer it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Where do you come out on vanilla milkshakes?
So I like all milkshakes. I will say that, but I got to tell you, Jim, one of my daughters orders vanilla milkshakes, and the last three or four times I've had to finish her vanilla milkshake, I decided they're not good.
Good,
they're
man.
Not.
Correct
get
answer.
Chocolate.
Ding,
get chocolate,
ding,
get cookies
ding.
And cream, get anything. Vanilla milkshakes are not good.
At all. At all. I'm so glad to hear you say that, Ross. And then if they're not good, where does that leave people, not including your daughter, of course, where does that leave people who drink them?
They should feel bad. Vanilla milkshakes are bad, and people that order them should feel bad, other than my daughter, Tess, who's awesome. Everybody else, there's usually like five or six better choices to get vanilla milkshake. And I like vanilla ice cream, but there's something not right about a vanilla milkshake. It just, it doesn't taste good, and people need to understand that they should stop ordering them. Anybody likes a vanilla milkshake, I guarantee if you try chocolate milkshake, you'll like it better. I guarantee it. Try it tonight.
If you try anything that's not vanilla, I guarantee it tastes better because it's vanilla. All right, now you and I talked on Radio Row in Atlanta, Ross, and one of the things we talked about was my front page story. Just mentioning it on the show, it seemed like you got a pretty good bounce. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think the server crashed. How is my front page story doing these days?
It's doing unbelievable, in large part thanks to you, Jim. You got a lot of people to listen, man, because when I was on the Super Bowl and I told everybody it was the best Valentine's Day gift I've ever heard of, a lot of people jumped in. Same with Mother's Day. Now we got a lot of people doing it for birthdays. I did it for my mom for her 70th birthday, or even anniversaries, weddings. If you need a cool, unique gift idea for your wife, your mom, whoever, myfrontpagestory.com. Trust me, it's the best gift I've seen in years.
Ross, I've got about a minute. For those who do not know what it is, explain it once again.
Yeah, so it's a great idea that I did not come up with. I'm just helping out. But it's a couple of newspaper writers, and all you have to do is you go to myfrontpagestory.com, you tell them your idea, what story you want. You talk to a reporter, Jim, for 10 minutes while you're driving home from work. Tell them how great your wife is or your mom or whoever. They write the story. You get sent a framed copy of the story. It looks like it's on the front cover of the newspaper. And I've yet to see one of these given to a woman and them not cry. My wife's grandma cried. My mom cried. It was just quotes from my sister and I talking about how much she meant to us for her 70th birthday. And both of them, by the way, already have it framed in their houses. Myfrontpagestory.com.
I love it. It's a great idea, and it works. Ross Tucker, former NFL player. He spent 7 years in the NFL as a player. He is an NFL analyst. He is the host of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. You can follow him at Ross Tucker NFL as well. Ross, great job. It's the best time of year, and it's great to have you back. Appreciate it so much.
Absolutely, Jim. Thanks for having me.
You got it, bud.
Good night.